Hello. Yeah, thanks for being here. Thanks to Steve and Erez and Una and Raphael for the opportunity to be part of this program and speak with you today. I hope you'll interrupt with questions. So the subject of my talk is metallic quantum criticality. And metallic quantum criticality has been, you know, long viewed as a possible cause of some of the sexiest phenomena in condensed matter physics, such as high TC superconductivity, non-Fermi liquid behavior especially. And it's, you know, conjectured to undergird the phase diagrams of many materials that are close to our hearts, organics, heavy fermions, iron-based superconductors, and of course the cuprates. So it's fairly easy to draw suggestive phase diagrams and to make conjectures about the consequences of metallic quantum criticality, but it's substantially harder to arrive at reliable results, either for microscopic models or for low energy effective field theories. Field theory, of course, which is the weapon of choice for understanding classical critical phenomena and quantum critical phenomena in insulators, encounters some, you know, numerous technical difficulties when applied to the metallic case. And you know, much progress has been made on this field theoretical effort to understand metallic quantum critical points, beginning with the work of Hertz, but there's still no consensus on even some basic facts about metallic quantum critical points. So I'm going to talk about two different pieces of work today, each of which avoids these famous technical difficulties in a different way. And both of them are going to concentrate on a specific case of a metallic quantum critical point, and that's an isognomatic quantum critical point in a single band metal in two spatial dimensions with no other interactions whatsoever. So we're throwing away a great deal of physics that is presumably relevant to all the materials I mentioned. We're trying to zoom in on the effects of isognomatic quantum critical fluctuations itself. Okay, so, you know, there, just to review what isognomatic order is and what it does to a Fermi surface. Pneumatic refers to, pneumatic comes from pneumatos, Greek for thread. It means in sort of an elongation. So it's symmetry-wise, it's the same as a tetragonal to orthorhombic transition in the isognomatic case. And in the case of a metal, we have a Fermi surface that will elongate along one of two directions. Okay. So there are a couple of reasons why we've chosen to study this particular form of electronic order. One is that it's simple. It's an ising order parameter that makes it handy to simulate. And in fact, it's amenable to Monte Carlo simulations without a fermion minus sign problem, which yields great insight. It's also true that isognomatic order is, there's evidence for isognomatic order in both the iron-based superconductors and cuprates. And finally, by virtue of the fact that isognomatic order preserves translation symmetry, the fluctuations of this order have a profound effect on the Fermi surface. So the way to see this is to contrast the isognomatic fluctuations with those of a density wave order like Nail antiferromagnetism. So on the left, you can see the antiferromagnetic case. And here, at least in a perturbative sense, we expect strong renormalizations of fermions only at certain hotspots. These hotspots are where the Fermi surface intersects itself when translated by the ordering wave vector. Elsewhere, you sort of have energy denominators that reduce the effect of these fluctuations. Okay, so it's only at hot spots, at least at a perturbative level, that you expect strong effects. By contrast, for an isognomatic QCP, the ordering wave vector is zero, and essentially the entire Fermi surface is hot. Okay, that is, with the exception of certain cold spots here along the zone diagonal, okay, where symmetry prohibits a coupling between the long wavelength pneumatic fluctuations and the fermionic degrees of freedom. Okay, so hot spots versus entirely hot with perhaps cold spots. So this will have consequences for, you know, all manner of electronic tendencies. So let me describe the major questions I'm going to try and address in my talk today. The first one is, can an isynematic quantum critical point rationalize this mysterious phenomenology of high TC superconductivity condensing out of a non-Fermi liquid normal state? Okay. And secondly, supposing we have an isynematic quantum critical point, what are some distinctive experimental consequences of this? So on this first question, we've investigated this via large-scale Monte Carlo simulations. This is a multi-year, multi-generational effort with my advisor, Steve Kivelson, his student, Erez Berg, Erez's student, Yoni Schottner, and we have a couple of papers on this. So, good. And I mentioned that the big questions I'm going to focus on with respect to this Monte Carlo work have to do with superconductivity or pairing versus non-Fermi liquid physics. So on this score, it is very well understood that an isynematic quantum critical point is incompatible with a Fermi liquid ground state. Okay? It's also well understood that the near critical quantum fluctuations of the isynematic order can dramatically enhance the tendency to pairing. And so there's a natural question of who wins. That is, it's perhaps reasonable to presume that the ultimate ground state is superconductivity, but this could happen in two different ways. One is this phase diagram, where you have a Fermi liquid condensing into superconductivity. Superconductivity preempts any other form of Fermi liquid breakdown. And another way, which more superficially at least resembles the cuprates and other materials, is to have a broad regime of non-Fermi liquid behavior above TC. And there have been various reports in the literature via with different theoretical methods pointing to either of these possibilities. It may depend on parameters. Today I'm going to give some numerical non-perturbative evidence for this happier, more exciting scenario. Okay. But before I do that, I should emphasize that the distinction between these two things is really only possible in a sharp sense at weak coupling. Because if we have weak coupling, we can have a parametric separation of scales and really speak with theoretical clarity about a non-Fermi liquid regime. But if, as is true in our numerics and presumably in real materials, the coupling is of order one, then it's just really a matter of numbers. So if we have a non-Fermi liquid above TC, it will be just, you know, some numerically larger scale when it sets in. And that's an important caveat in interpreting the results. All right, so I've set the stage here. Let me now describe to you the lattice Hamiltonian that we're going to treat. I'm going to treat it with quantum Monte Carlo, and I'll describe the results. And before I get into it, I would encourage you all to think of this as sort of a numerical experiment. Monte Carlo is in some ways a black box. It's not so really theory. It's doing these numerical simulations. We do measurements. We have limitations in parameter space. We have statistical and other errors. The advantage of Monte Carlo over a real experiment is that we can throw away all the complications of real materials and focus on, in this case, isynematic quantum critical fluctuations. Okay, so I'm going to present some phenomenology to you. And one thing I can say for sure is that it all comes from isynematic quantum critical fluctuations. Good. So this is our experimental system, a microscopic Hamiltonian. It consists of two sectors. The first sector is the fermions. They have, you know, hop on a square lattice, nearest neighbor hopping for simplicity. They're spin 1/2, and they have some arbitrary chemical potential. The next sector represents the pneumatic degrees of freedom, and we represent these using pseudo-spins that live on the bonds of this lattice. So I say pseudo because these spins have nothing to do with fermionic spins. They're time reversal even, okay? And they're really just to represent the pneumatic ordering tendency of the system. They're governed by a transverse field Ising model, and that transverse, the icing part, the exchange V, prefers to anti-align nearest neighbor spins, and thereby break the XY rotational symmetry of the lattice, as you can see in this picture here. So that's, you know, spontaneous symmetry breaking when V dominates, whereas when H, the transverse field, dominates, all the pseudospins point in the same direction, and the rotational symmetry, the spatial rotational symmetry, is preserved. Okay, so H is going to be our quantum tuning parameter, analogous to pressure or perhaps doping in the real material context.
How important is the sign of the V here?
Say again?
How important is the sign of the V?
Very. Yeah, so if V were negative, then we would want all of these to align the same way, right? And there would be no breaking of rotational symmetry. There would actually be no breaking of symmetry at all. Because as it turns out, I haven't gotten to the end of the Hamiltonian yet, there is no sigma z to minus sigma z symmetry of the Hamiltonian.
Is this the square lattice?
Yes.
Shouldn't you can do a transformation to change the sign?
Oh, no, actually. As it turns out, not at finite chemical potential. Yeah.
In the icing, the real spin icing system, of course, the H is the transverse field.
Yes.
What is the physical realization of the pseudo field H?
What is the physical?
How can you realize for this pseudo spins the transverse field H?
In a real material setting?
In a physical sense.
I don't have a particularly good answer for that, but the main point is that sigma x is something that is essentially like the energy density. It's a scalar under the symmetries of the problem. So when I say pressure or something, it's more or less as good as a symmetry breaking field. Steve, you and Ian have some more proper microscopic ways of thinking of transverse field icing Hamiltonians and
in
quadrupolar systems.
Yeah. So whatever tunes the quantum fluctuation.
Yes, here we
go. Yeah. Good. So
we can show you examples.
So yes, this is the transverse field icing model governed by this tuning parameter H. If we were thinking in a continuum field theory, this would essentially be the scalar phi to the fourth theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, where H tunes this mass term, m squared. Okay. So separately, these two sectors are each tremendously well understood, and the magic happens when I couple them together. And the way I do that is by putting this kind of Yukawa-type coupling. So sigma z on a given bond couples to the kinetic energy operator on that bond. And the strength in dimensionless, in units of the hopping, is given by alpha. So that, in the ordered phase shown here, effectively you have an increased hopping along the x-directed bonds and a decreased hopping along the y-directed bonds. And this gives you the elongation of the Fermi surface, and this is how the symmetry is broken in the electronic sector. Good. So we're going to solve this with determinant quantum Monte Carlo, which was developed by Blank and Deckler and Doug and Sugar back in 1981. And this method, it maps a two-dimensional quantum problem to a three-dimensional classical problem. And it's expensive. Even though we don't have the fermion sign problem, it's still quite expensive, but numerically exact and unbiased. So we're not making any, prejudicial assumptions about the physics. We're just going to sample the appropriate statistical distribution. And we have to make sure our simulations converge. But if they do, we can put error bars on all of our measured quantities, and we can be sure of the results. Okay. Good. So the parameter choices, we've explored a fair chunk of parameter space in this multi-year collaboration. But today, for our purposes, I'm going to focus on one particularly strong coupling set of simulation parameters shown here. We can get up to about 24 by 24 in system size and down to a small, very small fraction of the single particle hopping in temperature. And we have a imaginary time discretization, which is 1/20th of the inverse hopping, to the extent that matters. Good. So, basic results about the physics. Okay, the transition remains continuous down to the lowest accessible temperatures. This was not a foregone conclusion. We got lucky that it's not first order. We find, even at somewhat weaker couplings than I'll show you today, that the bosonic sector is strongly renormalized by the coupling to fermions. I'm not sure if I said this before. By bosonic sector here, I mean the pseudospin sector. And also, the fermions also become strongly renormalized by the coupling to bosons and become superconducting at an accessible temperature for strong enough coupling. Yes, Laura?
Before you go further, I mean, I lost a previous point. When you modify your Hamiltonian in order to couple with the pneumatic, let's say, interaction, mm-hmm. are you modifying only the nearest neighbor hopping, I mean, along the bond?
Yes.
But, I mean, you can imagine to couple these even, I mean, to other kind of hopping, or, for example, even locally, you can construct two sublattices with different on-site energy, for example, and you are able to induce some anisotropic.
So within a single band model, which is what we're doing, for simplicity's sake and for, you know, numerical efficiency, the simplest way to get this is to modify the nearest neighbor hopping. But indeed, there could be many, many other microscopic realizations of pneumatic order that
actually
have the same symmetry
one.
Properties.
Yeah, but I'm asking, are you able to do it even easily, I mean, easier way, touching only the on-site energy of the practice site?
To do an on-site, we would need to have two orbitals that have different symmetries.
Oh, I mean, you cannot change two...
That breaks translation symmetry.
Yeah, I see, I see. You need at least two orbitals. Yeah, okay, sorry.
Okay, good. So, without further ado, the phase diagram. Okay, so as expected, we have a pneumatic phase at small h, we have a tetragonal phase at large h, and we have the desired superconducting dome, which has a peak in its TC near the quantum critical value of the tuning parameter. Okay, and furthermore, this TC max is substantial. It's a tenth of the hopping, or a few percent of the Fermi energy. This is high TC. For reference, the optimal TC of the negative U Hubbard model is near this. Okay, so indeed, we found high TC superconductivity, and we can determine, I should mention that we determine these phase boundaries in various different, roughly, basically standard ways. TC in particular, we determine at least three ways. One is by looking at the pair field susceptibility. This is in the S wave channel, I should mention. This susceptibility diverges in the thermodynamic limit below TC, but approaches a finite value in the thermodynamic limit above TC. The spin susceptibility has a precipitous drop near TC, representing the opening of a singlet spin gap. And then, most reliably, we can measure the superfluid stiffness, which we can extract from the current correlation function. And this approaches zero in the thermodynamic limit above TC, a finite value below, and has its Costolous-Thouless jump value of 2 TC over pi at the transition. Yes?
It's S-wave,
D-wave, or it's S-wave. It is, we're still ironing down the precise details of the gap function, but it's some form of an extended S wave. So it has an on-site component, but also some further neighbor pairing elements as well.
Sam, what was the dashed line in the previous slide?
The dashed line is a crossover scale out of the so-called quantum critical regime. It's defined by taking, sit at HC at a given temperature, measure the pneumatic susceptibility, then march along H until it's dropped by half, and that's where you draw the dotted line.
So what did you take for Fermi surface? You took something?
We took, I showed you the value of the chemical potential. It was equal to the hopping, it's something, you know, it's a hole-like Fermi surface with a substantial, yeah, cuprate-like, but we haven't put in the next nearest neighbor hopping, so it's sort of flat on the edges. You'll see.
Your technique will work on any type of Fermi surface?
Yes. As long as we haven't broken, say, time reversal symmetry or things like that. Good. So I've demonstrated to you high temperature superconductivity. Now I want to talk about the normal state and to what extent it deviates from Fermi liquid theory.
Sam, before you go there, how does TC, the optimal TC, varies with alpha?
Yeah, we haven't done extensive studies as a function of alpha, in part because you need alpha to be quite large in order to see anything, but it's consistent with alpha squared from what little data we have.
Presumably, it flattens off right when you go to very large alpha.
Yes, and not exactly. There's a quirk of this model that alpha affects the band structure, the bandwidth, as well as the... So, yeah, we haven't pursued that much. Good. So, in order to characterize the normal state, we're going to have to talk about dynamics. And this is where I have to be honest with you that extracting dynamics from quantum Monte Carlo simulations is challenging, because quantum Monte Carlo is done in imaginary time, and dynamics, you know, at least experimentally relevant dynamics, are in real time. So you need to analytically continue from Matsubara to real frequency to get experimentally relevant quantities, and this introduces uncontrolled errors. So we're going to find ways around this, but inevitably there will be uncertainties associated with this process that are hard to quantify. So one probe of single particle properties is the spectral function. That's measured, for instance, in ARCES. We can measure the imaginary time Green function, and a useful identity relates the Green function at imaginary time separation beta over 2 to a suitable integral of the spectral function. This is essentially integrating the spectral function about zero frequency in a window of width equal to the temperature. Okay, so it's a lot like an ARPES MDC, if you like, with an integrating window that's equal to the temperature. And a handy fact is that in a Fermi liquid regime, twice this Green function will be the quasi-particle residue as you approach zero temperature, if you're in a Fermi liquid. Okay, so this is what it looks like for free fermions at beta equals 6. We'll stick to this temperature with our chosen band structure. So here's the Fermi surface. You can see we have discretized momenta because we have a finite system size. Good. So now we're going to fix the temperature and approach HC from higher values of H and see what happens. So here's H equals 5.5 well into the disordered phase. We see something that looks essentially like the free fermion result. Moving on to a smaller value of H, now we can see some interaction effects, but you could still identify this as a Fermi surface, right? Reasonably well defined, though blurrier out near the zone boundary than the zone diagonal. This is where that cold spot physics comes in. It's a symmetry feature of pneumatic fluctuations. But still, we have substantial values of z, if you will, over the full Fermi surface. But now, if we go close to the QCP, the Fermi surface is very, very hard to identify, if at all, out near the zone boundary, while it remains reasonably sharp near the zone diagonal. Okay? So so this is a sort of a qualitative way of seeing this, but we can definitely say that there's a pronounced loss of low-energy spectral weight where the pneumatic fluctuations couple most strongly to the fermions, and a pretty solid preservation of low-energy spectral weight at the cold spot. Okay, so that's one way of looking at single particle properties. A complementary way is to look at the Matsubara self-energy. And we'll look at the imaginary part of the self-energy, which in the zero Matsubara frequency limit can be interpreted as a scattering rate. So among the features of this, I'll get to the data in a second, at HC, the self-energy has essentially no temperature dependence from TC up to basically the hopping in temperature. At the cold spot, as we may have expected from the previous pictures, the quasi-particles are nearly coherent, meaning that if we extrapolate the self-energy to low frequency, it goes to zero. But elsewhere, there's no apparent Fermi surface. That is, we get an apparent scattering rate that's essentially independent of temperature and frequency, and it's large. It far exceeds the lowest temperatures we reach. Okay, so let me just show this to you. On the left here, we have momentum at the nominal Fermi surface at the cold spot. Different symbols represent different temperatures. These are fermionic Matsubara frequencies. And what you can see is that, you know, except for this upturn at the smallest temperatures, the squares and circles, which are below TC, the trend is downward, extrapolating to something that's maybe not zero, but quite small, 0.1 or 0.2. If you were to extract a scattering rate, you'd say it would be, you know, comparable to or lower than the lowest non-superconducting temperature. So this, what I'd say, is at least a marginally coherent quasiparticle. By contrast, out near the zone boundary, where we didn't see a Fermi surface, where it was all blurry, we see, again, this upturn for the circles and squares, some of which is cut off. But if we extrapolate to low Matsubara frequency from above TC, we get a gigantic elastic scattering rate, if you will, of order the hopping, a third of the Fermi energy. Okay? This is much more non-Fermi than any non-Fermi liquid prediction that I know of. Most field theoretical approaches would expect to have a self-energy that vanishes as some power of omega, like omega to the two-thirds. This is much more extreme than that.
Not much temperature dependence to it.
It's within the statistical error for this temperature range. Yeah. And I haven't put error bars on this data yet, but there is a systematic variation of this damping rate or a scattering rate that you'd extract as you go around the Fermi surface. Over here is the cold spot. Over here is the zone boundary. And I can't help but compare this to a similar anisotropy that's observed in ARPES on optimally doped disco by Kaminsky et al. So this is an interesting phenomenological result of these pneumatic fluctuations. And what this phenomenology looks like more than anything is sort of disorder scattering, right? We expect a non-zero scattering rate in the low temperature, low frequency limit if we have quench disorder. Here, this would be something like a pneumatic glass because it has this anisotropy that really is the hallmark of cold spot physics. And as I mentioned before, it's unlike any theoretical treatment that I'm aware of, and we're still working to understand this. Okay, we've seen strong non-Fermi liquid features in single particle properties. We would like also to see whether this is evidenced in transport, right? That's another hallmark of, say, the strange metal phase of the cuprates, for instance.
I have one question.
Yes.
Are they, you are using the pneumatic glass, but I presume that there is no, are there any self-generated inhomogeneities? If you look at some, is everything translation invariant in the translation invariant? If you look at any, you go from one point to another in the...
Yeah, this is an important question. So explicitly, we do not put any disorder into our model. Right, yeah. We don't expect glassy behavior, but we've also verified, looking at, say, imaginary time averaged behaviors, do they systematically vary from lattice site to another for some reason, for any, you know, non-equilibrium convergence problem reason, and we see no evidence of this. It does appear to be a translationally invariant system with the dynamics with which we have endowed it.
But glassy systems have some other features also, for example, the way activation may occur for different, I don't know, things may get stuck somewhere.
Yeah, perhaps I shouldn't have said the word glass. Let's not take the analogy too far.
That's fine.
Good. So I was proceeding to transport properties of the normal state. Okay. And here all of my caveats about dynamics and imaginary versus real time go double. Analytic continuation is for the DC resistivity, especially has severe numerical ill conditioning. Let me just lay out the state of affairs here. We can measure the current correlator, which I call lambda of tau. Okay. And lambda of tau and its Fourier transform, lambda of omega n, are precisely related to suitable integrals of the real part of the optical conductivity. Okay. If we could just invert these relations to get sigma of omega, then we'd be done. But this is much easier said than done. Okay. And so we've used a couple of different methods, which we think are somewhat distinct, but may rely on overlapping assumptions to extract the DC resistivity, which is one thing we really care about. Okay. These methods include doing analytic continuation by maximum entropy, which is a widely used technique. Another way is what we've called a resistivity proxy. We can look at lambda of tau and its derivatives in the vicinity of beta over 2 and form something that has the units of resistivity and agrees with the resistivity for, say, a Lorentzian. And finally, and perhaps most simply, we can just do curve fitting. This is a very sort of naive technique, but we can assume that the conductivity is a sum of 2 Lorentzians, and that turns out to give a good fit for the lambda of omega n data. So I'll show you that here. On the left, the blue data points are measured current correlator as a function of omega n. There's a question?
Could you go back to the previous slide? So when you say Lorentz oscillators, you mean like you take like a Drude-like model with 2 different scattering times, or?
No. So it's a Lorentz oscillator is you center your peak at some non-zero frequency, and then it also has a width. So there's an additional parameter.
I mean, it can choose zero.
It can be at zero frequency, but the parameters are an amplitude, a peak position, and then a damping rate.
And you take 2 of them because?
Because one of them won't do. This will become clear. Roughly speaking, you need 2 Lorentzians because there's this apparent discontinuity between the zeroth and the first Matsubara frequency in the current correlator. And what that corresponds to in real frequency is there appears to be a relatively narrow Drude-like peak at low frequency and then some broad background. Okay, so this is why a 2-component fit is sort of the minimal ingredient, the minimal assumptions we need to reproduce our data. So, as I said, grains of salt, but these are the results for optical conductivity at a couple of different temperatures. Drude-esque peak, broad background with maybe a hump feature around the bandwidth. Okay. So now let me overlay the DC resistivity extracted by this method on the phase diagram. This color plot may look like experimental data. It is not a resistivity exponent, as is commonly done. This is literally the value of the resistivity and units of the quantum of resistance. Okay, and so you can see it's non-monotonic in H. It has a peak somewhere around HC, and then it goes down again. And you can see up at temperatures of 0.5 or so, it substantially exceeds the quantum of resistance. To see a little bit more detail here, we can look at the temperature dependence at 3 chosen values of H, and that's presented here. Okay, so both above and below HC, we have relatively small resistivities. Below HC, roughly consistent with T squared or T to the fourth behavior. Above HC is a little bit confusing. It appears to be linear with a slightly negative intercept. The Fermi liquid regime is perhaps where we least trust our methods of analytic continuation, so this doesn't bother us too much. At HC, though, we are relatively confident in in the method of extracting the resistivity, and what we find is a rapid rise, approximately linear with temperature, and it exceeds the quantum of resistance, which is one version of the Yoffe-Regel limit, at a temperature about three times Tc, but well below the Fermi energy, and it shows no signs of resistivity saturation. Okay. So to summarize, for this strong coupling set of parameters, our model exhibits high Tc superconductivity. It exhibits a non-Fermi liquid normal state in a range of temperatures above Tc with highly anisotropic single particle lifetimes. And it also exhibits anomalous transport, consistent with the so-called bad metal phenomenology. Okay. So I still have a little bit of time, so I'm going to tell you about the second part of the talk.
I really have a little bit of time, but...
I don't. I thought it was... What are the talks supposed to be?
25 minutes.
25 minutes. Oh, my. I should have asked you. I'm so sorry.
Maybe you can just lay out so that people can come and ask you later.
Oh, my. They're a space-flying tower. I'm so sorry.
We don't want to miss the chance to ask questions on the party's just finished.
Right.
Yeah, that's embarrassing. In brief, the second part of the talk is answering the question, what are some distinctive consequences of a QCP? And here we think a great probe is Raman scattering. This is work done with Erez, Avi Klein at Minnesota, Andrei Chubakov, and Dibanjan Chowdhury at MIT. So, basically, it's a diagrammatic calculation. In a one-loop computation, you find zero for Raman scattering because the pneumatic order parameter is effectively conserved. Okay, so a conserved quantity has no response at zero momentum and finite frequency, which is the regime that Raman probes. But if you... In the case of a pneumatic order parameter, where the order parameter has no microscopic conservation law, then you can have non-trivial dynamics at zero momentum and finite frequency that should be legible to Raman. We found a way to analytically control a diagrammatic computation in two broad regimes of frequency, and our results involve these two and three loop diagrams. And the result essentially is here, that there's a regime of mod omega, a regime of mod omega to the 1/3 in the B1G channel.
At the
QCP at zero temperature, avoiding the questions of superconductivity and disorder. So the prediction here is that there's a characteristic singular frequency dependence that should be seen in a divergent Raman conductivity, that's the intensity over omega. I apologize for being so wrong about the time allotted to me. So I'll just flash my conclusions.
Good, yeah.
Could we go to your phase diagram where there was some bright red color up at the upper left-hand corner?
Yeah.
There we go. So, I mean, we have to give theorists an inch or two, but does it bother you that your lines don't come down at the peak of the dome? I mean, you said near and slid it on by.
Does it bother me that my lines don't come down?
The quantum critical point being the peak.
Ah, so here's the quantum critical point. Here's the maximum Tc. Here at high temperature is the peak of the resistivity, the fact that these don't coincide in H.
Yes.
Yeah. This does not bother me at all. And the reason is that you may expect some precise agreement between these various things in the low temperature and weak coupling limit. But in a strong coupling problem like this, it's, I would say that, that details of band structure and other induced non-critical interactions can shift this stuff around. So for me, it's good enough that the dome is roughly centered near HC and that this peak of the resistivity is trending towards HC in the low temperature limit. That is important.
But conversely, I mean, you know, as Sam said, everything here is due to pneumatic fluctuations. We know that for sure. There's nothing else. So this shows you the sort of accuracy with which you can say, you know, if it's quantum critical fluctuations, do we expect you to see something precisely peak the critical point? The answer is no.
Well, but near is still good.
Near is good.
Yeah, I think near is good.
But we also see that it's...
But what I wanted him to do, which he did, was he told us the things that might move it off from the peak. Because, you know, there's something besides the simple model you've used. And so you sort of gave us some reasons why it might not be there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it needs a reason at strong coupling, but I can give you reasons.
Greg, do you always think it's there in all the interviews? I mean, it's precisely as you're saying, somehow you
just... No. Not always there, but it's freaking ubiquitous. It's something fundamental that, for instance, in the peptides, that those lines come down and really light the peak of the dome. And in the cuprates as well, right? I mean, I'm not the big cuprate expert, but...
Cuprates are less clear.
But there are cuprate systems where it looks very peptide-like, right?
Electron dope cuprates.
Yeah. Neodymium, et cetera.
I thought that was crazy stuff. So that the deformation of Fermi surface is the simplest type of von Mrontruc instability. Mm-hmm. And the question is, could you extend this in any way to more complicated changes of Fermi surface?
Yeah. So there are a variety of zero momentum ways to deform a Fermi surface. You can do it in the spin channel or the charge channel. In a tetragonal system, I don't think there are higher angular momentum things that come into play.
There are, but we can't do them. Like, there's angular momentum 3, there's Chandra loop order.
Right.
Right, but that's kind right. of minus sign problem.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I think Katrine is next.
For your transport result with the linear resistivity, is it correct if I understand it this way, that you have some quasi-particle self-energy which doesn't have any temperature dependence, but which is big and finite, and on top of that you have some forward scattering terms which would produce some extra T dependence?
To say, you know, forward scattering terms, this comes into interpretation. It's correct that we have essentially.
I would like you to do
this is
in terms of a Boltzmann more.
Yeah. So what I would say is that if you want to interpret it in a Boltzmann sense, you have to interpret our single particle self energies as being forward scattering lifetimes. If you were to do just a relaxation time approximation, you get a larger value of the resistivity with less temperature.
Then you get an extra temperature dependence due to forward scattering, due to the angle in forward scattering.
The back scattering self, the transport lifetime is very different and will have some different temperature dependence than the single particle lifetime would be the interpretation.
Basically, you just add the scaling of the forward scattering angle, that's multiplying the lifetime of the single particle, and you get it.
What I'm...
Yeah, wrong quantum critical point was going on.
Right. So that effect in the traditional approach near a quantum critical point would indeed tend to reduce. Sorry, would intend to increase the transport lifetime relative to the single particle.
I don't understand what the proposition is.
The proposition: you always increase the temperature power law by forward scattering terms.
Why? I thought forward scattering doesn't contribute much at all.
No, it increases the power law that you get for transport.
So you have a lifetime.
Lifetime going like, say, a linear in T, and then you are in 3D and you have forward scattering angle, and you would get T to the, I don't know, higher temperature. I don't have that in mind at the moment, it's a long time ago. But you increase by some temperature factor due to forward scattering mechanism.
So that would give you insulating behavior. I mean, here
no,
we
that,
have,
that would, could
we go
work.
From temperature independent
to
quasi-particle lifetime.
Clinarity.
If that was the forward
linearity, that's, it could work, why not? So you get some extra temperature dependence due to the forward scattering term.
I don't think so.
Yeah, we can.
I think that's the T5 law in the Grünheisen law in relativity compared to the thermal conductivity which causes T3.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
yeah.
the point. Yeah,
yeah that's the point.
Is this a discussion about 1 minus cosine theta?
Yes. So you get some.
Yeah, it gives you two. It gives you two powers of some appropriate momentum scale. Yeah.
So we're just asking whether this temperature dependence was coming from forward scattering terms.
Yeah, within a Boltzmann interpretation, that has to be it.
It was mine too, actually.
But it is true that if you just naively, you know, calculate the bubble without taking bridge expressions into account, you
yeah.
get a resistivity which is too high, significantly. Right, and that's one possible explanation.
I mean, look, we can't. You can't use Boltzmann transport. The scattering rate is the Fermi energy. I mean,
still, it has to come from somewhere, the extra temperature dependence.
Yeah, any information on the Fermi surface dependence of the gap?
Yes. We haven't done the systematic analysis that I'd like to do, but. Yeah, the variation is from the cold spot. Yeah, so at the hottest point of the Fermi surface, my estimate is that the gap is about 50% bigger than it is here at the cold spot. That's roughly what I have to say about that.
So I have a question on the model, not on this particular phase diagram you obtained.
Sure.
So this you cover like a company, right? You have, you know, we generate some kind of RKKY interaction between sigma z, right? And this is should be, you know, that will before the neighbor interaction between sigma z, that will compete with your nearest neighbor v interaction. Right? Presumably, if one explore your model in a more broad first type, broad parameter space, you will obtain more different kind of sigma z order.
Yeah, if you make alpha big enough, you could get some different wave vector anti-ferro arrangement of pseudospins. Yeah, that's not something that we've seen. Certainly the possibility of other orders being nucleated near a quantum critical point is a scenario that we're interested in. We haven't found evidence for it in the parameters we've explored so far.
Any other questions, comments? All right, good. Let's thank both of our speakers.